No matter how you feel about immigration into the United States and what you make of the images of people who try to do so, even though the law is an obstacle, you have to wonder why. Why people would give up their lives, travel, their old lives rather, travel so far, endure so much hardship to get across the U.S. border when lots of people do not want them to do so. Well, life is hard back home, you've heard many times. Our next guest has looked closely at the situation. Lynn Stephen is a professor of anthropology at the University of Oregon. She's an expert in immigration and asylum and is our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. Dr. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Glad to be here today.
So you have personally witnessed both ends of the migration. Tell us a bit about where you've been and what you've looked for.
Okay. Well, for the past 4 years, I've been conducting research in Guatemala, primarily in Huehuetenango and Quetzaltenango, which are two equivalent states in the United States that border Mexico. And Huehuetenango in particular sends a very high number of migrants to the U.S., really all over, but including here in Oregon. And I actually began that work in part because of indigenous refugees from Huehuetenango that were settling in and around Oregon and were initiating asylum cases. And last year, I was on sabbatical, and I spent the year on the U.S.-Mexico border at the Center for U.S.-Mexican Studies at the University of California, San Diego, and I went to Tijuana, which was very close by, and spent some time in shelters there and soup kitchens, and I also volunteered in a shelter in San Diego run by a group called the Rapid Response Network.
Volunteered doing what?
Right. So in Huehuetenango, our research concentrates in part on understanding the causes of gender violence and often violence against children in indigenous communities. And that's involved actually sitting in court there and listening extensively to cases and interviewing judges and lawyers and survivors of families, and then also working in a number of communities. And this year we did focus groups, about five or six focus groups with women, and also talking to some men about violence and lack of access to sort of police and the justice system. And migration came up in all the conversations. I would say people said 6-7 out of 10 households in these communities had someone who was already in the U.S.
So a high number then. But so what are the circumstances? Who is causing the violence in Huehuetenango?
Well, it's a complex set of issues, and that's why it's great to have a little bit of time to talk about it on the radio instead of a one-liner.
Right, we do have that.
Yeah. So it's really a combination. I mean, historically, Central America, Guatemala had a very bloody, many people have called it genocidal civil war, particularly against indigenous people. So there's a history of violence involving the Guatemalan army, then involving groups that were called civil patrols that were kind of deputized by the army but were indigenous people from indigenous communities that were supposed to be on the lookout for guerrillas or identifying people who were opposed to the government or non-sympathetic. And then Guatemala signed peace accords in 1996, and there was hope that a reformed national police force and a reformed justice system would really improve that situation. And to a limited degree, it has. There have been some high-profile legal cases that have put some, shall we say, very bad people in the military in prison for atrocities they committed during the Civil War. But there also was a vacuum of power in many places. And another thing that kind of happened simultaneously, I don't know if you listeners remember that U.S. drug interdiction policy was actually focused in the Caribbean in the 90s. Kind of Miami Vice, you know, mm-hmm. kind of put that on TV. But as the U.S. put pressure on the Caribbean. In fact, Colombian cocaine traffickers and Mexican cartels that at that point in time were simply distributing cocaine and later other substances in the U.S. Began to push their routes through Central America. So at the time that these civil wars were ending and there were power vacuums, Mexican organized crime began to, you know, the borders right there, the southern border of Mexico, the Huehuetenango and other places, to penetrate and have a strong presence not only in trafficking but in influencing politicians, in influencing politics in a big way. So despite the fact that Guatemala has had a very important anti-corruption commission that was joined between the UN and the government, that commission was basically just forced out and ended, and they put quite a number of people in jail, politicians, particular who were accused of corruption. And one of the things that they found was that parts of the budget, like the health, the national health budget or the education budget or infrastructure, instead of being spent as it was supposed, it was allocated to like improve conditions in the countryside, it was going into people's pockets or being used in other ways. So the story of that involves a couple of important elements, which is that basic programs that we would assume would be there for access to health care, access to education, access to infrastructure and development have not reached everywhere and have been affected by corruption. And at the same time, organized crime came to have a very significant presence and to, you know, penetrate a lot of the spaces of security. And also to begin to have a presence in local politics and in communities. So in some communities, there are gangs that have developed over, let's say, the past 10 or 15 years. In some cases, they may be linked to organized crime. In other cases, not, but they exact a heavy toll on locals. These are in indigenous communities, and these may be indigenous people in these gangs that extort, that threaten, that may be involved in acts of physical violence, and then pay off police so that they're not kept in prison. So there's a lot of impunity that exists in communities for small and large crimes. The economy has suffered, infrastructure has suffered, and then there's climate change, which has resulted in something called the Dry Corridor that extends in Honduras, in Guatemala, and eastern, Honduras, El Salvador, and eastern Guatemala, but also the rain patterns have changed in western Guatemala as well. So a lot of people who may have worked as laborers, or if they happen to have land, which a lot of people do not, are not harvesting what they need, or there's no work. So it's a combination of those kinds of circumstances that are causing people to flee. And I think the final thing is that many communities in Guatemala they began to flee in the 1980s. They began to come to the United States in the 1980s, and they began to get asylum at that time. And in fact, many communities have legal, even U.S. citizen members. So that gives people a resource and a place to go in the U.S. So a majority of people who've been coming recently have a relative here, you know, and they're going all over the United States. So that's a long explanation, but that's kind of the variety of factors that I've seen in the work that I do.
No, we absolutely appreciate the detail. Lynn Stephen is a professor of anthropology at the University of Oregon, our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. She's an expert on immigration and asylum, and we're talking about the reasons that people leave their countries in Central America and head for the U.S. border, despite a lot of headwinds that they have to face to get there in the first place and then to get across in the second. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. The sense of region-wide danger in going about your daily life, I mean, are there stable countries down there somewhere where things are okay? And are those targets at all for migration from, say, Guatemala?
There's been incredible turmoil and violence in the three countries called the Northern Triangle. Mm-hmm. Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. I mean, Honduras, the murder rates have gone down a little bit, but both Honduras and El Salvador had very high, you know, the fourth or third or first highest murder rates in the world and definitely in the region. Nicaragua also has had a lot of turmoil, a student movement that sought really to push for elections and democracy and democratic reforms in Nicaragua was very severely repressed by the president there. And many Nicaraguans have gone to Costa Rica, and because it's a bordering country. So Costa Rica is another country that has received, historically, it's received migrants and immigrants, and people have moved back and forth from Nicaragua. And it may be, you know, it may be that some people from Guatemala and El Salvador will begin to go there. But, the biggest, one of the factors in where people decide to try to go when they leave under these desperate circumstances is a place, you know, is having a place to go. So Guatemalans historically have not migrated to Costa Rica. So because of the history, I mean, that's an interesting thing about immigration that's important to think about. First of all, every individual is linked to an extended family, what we call kinship or family network. And I work with a concept that I call transborder communities, and these are communities that could be in Mexico, it could be in Guatemala, who are rooted in multiple places inside of a country. They maybe also have people, for example, there's a number of communities I've worked in from Huehuetenango. They have settlements inside of Guatemala elsewhere because they've been displaced repeatedly because of the war. They have settlements of people in Mexico, and then they have settlements of people in like four or five, six states in the U.S. So it reflects a long history of violence and displacement that this current wave of people that we're seeing are a part of. So they're likely, they're connected to that prior history and that prior violence. So they're much more likely to go where there's already a network. And one of the things I observed, for example, I mentioned that I worked in a shelter in San Diego, and there's been a report put out sort of analyzing some of the intake data that we took in. And about half the people there were from Guatemala. The next group was Honduras, El Salvador, and then there were actually ultimately like 19 different countries that people came from, because the global smuggling routes actually can go from India or Africa to Brazil to Ecuador to Panama through Central America to Mexico into the U.S., and all those people came across the border. But Hondurans, for example, do not have the same kind of deep history of migrating, emigrating to the U.S. The Salvadorans do, for the very same reasons. The United States spent $5.2 billion aiding the Salvadoran army in the Salvadoran Civil War. There were many, many deaths and disappeared, but also many displaced people, and they came to the U.S. and settled in the U.S. So for Salvadorans and Guatemalans, almost all of them have a relative or someone, known through family networks, whereas Honduras, that was less the case. Some of them had family connections, but other ones would say they were going to stay with a friend or a friend of a friend. So that's, I think, the biggest, factor in terms of why people come here, particularly from El Salvador.
They've got someone to go see.
Yeah,
they've got a person
exactly.
to stay with.
Just,
yeah.
I mean, it's a perfectly logical thing. And if you look at the pattern, the long-term pattern of immigration into the U.S., whether it's, Italian or whether it's Irish or whether it's Scottish, you follow out family networks. And in the same way, people also remain networked, back to their communities.
Well, I've noticed the work you've done and the reports on the transborder population with the current immigration approach from Washington. Is that transborder lifestyle still possible?
Well, it's certainly a challenge. And one of the things that's happened, not just because of our current policy, but, basically since 1996, I mean, it was under Bill Clinton that we actually first, we got the first pieces of the wall. We got a number of policies that penalized people, you know, if they were already here and could be convicted of even small misdemeanors, they could be deported. We limited access, you know, to social services. Undocumented people have no right, no access to any kind of social service. So at that point in time, it became very much more risky for people who may have been here undocumented to return, right, particularly to Mexico. I've studied this a lot in Mexico. So, you know, and people are here 20 years. They have kids. Their kids are citizens. They may have grandkids. So the grandkids or the kids can go back and forth because they're citizens. And I actually, I produced a film, directed a film here called Sad Happiness, and it's the story of a 11-year-old girl who's a U.S. citizen and who goes back for the first time to the community where her parents are from. And she gets to know her extended family, and she can go back and forth because she's a citizen, but her parents cannot. And I've actually seen quite a number of families that I personally know in Oregon do that, where they send their children, and people have done research about this in Tijuana or San Diego in Texas. So there is that contact that happens, maybe not from the people who left, who are here, who are undocumented, or it's difficult for them to leave, but people, a lot of these communities, if they've, you know, from Mexico, for example, you know, these communities, they started sending people with the Bracero program in the, you know, in the 40s
yeah,
and the 50s. So there's multiple generations in a family, you know, with legal status that allows them to go back and forth. For Hondurans or communities that, you know, have a more shallow experience or more shallow roots, we could say that might be harder. But it is something that, you know, that still persists. But one of the other results of sort of these cumulative policies through time is that some people who maybe would want to go back or go back and forth or have the ability to come and go, they're really limited because they can't, you know, they don't want to risk what you risk to come back in.
Just a few minutes left with Lynn Steven, professor of anthropology at the University of Oregon, talking about immigration, asylum, and gendered asylum, too, which we hope we'll get to here on the Jefferson Exchange. We have an email here from Patricia Ann in Eureka, who asks you to please discuss the role of governmental overthrows by the U.S. in the current time.
Okay.
And let me add to that anything else that we've tried to do to help these countries so that the spur to move northward is not there.
Yes. Well, that's a very important point, and that's another point that we don't, you know, we don't get to talk about is, you know, U.S. history in the region and the connection, the long connection that this current immigration has to the wars in Central America. I mean, I mentioned, you know, we could look at U.S. intervention. The U.S. intervened in 1954 in Guatemala. And was involved in essentially a, you know, coup, getting rid of a democratically elected president, Jacobo Arbenz, who was involved in serious agrarian reform that would have redistributed land, that would have supported unionism and a lot of other kinds of things that perhaps would have begun to decrease the great inequalities that we see in Central American countries, in Guatemala and El Salvador. The United States, as I mentioned, supported, under Ronald Reagan in particular, supported a very repressive Salvadoran regime. They certified, you know, progress in human rights when clearly it wasn't happening. Very famous massacre of 500 people is actually now in a court, massacre in El Mozote, of at least 500 people, or the numbers may even be higher, involving hundreds of children. So there's a clear link between U.S. foreign policy and sort of presence in the region and supporting repressive regimes. And right now in Guatemala, I mean, Trump, our president, put a lot of pressure on the current president, Jimmy Morales to sign, you know, he did the same thing with Mexico to basically bully the Mexican president, and then the following week, the Guatemalan president into agreeing with U.S. policy and supporting current a whole series of things to discourage people from coming. And Guatemala just had elections, and a right-wing candidate, Gia Mateus, who was the head of the prison system and is very close with the military and close with people who were involved in the civil war in what many people would term genocide. So there's a history since the 50s or before. I mean, we could keep going further back in time in Central America and the Caribbean. So
Lynn Steven, before we go then, about a minute left here, I mean, because there are so many people in the United States concerned about the people who keep coming, is there a historical precedent here or something that hasn't been tried yet that might work to restore some stability in the countries to the south so that people would not want to be leaving so
right.
much?
Well, we need to look at corruption, and the Anti-Corruption Commission called CICIG in Guatemala is a great model for what can be done, but it needs to be supported politically, not only by the United States, but by, you know, politics in Guatemala. We need to really look at at organized crime, at economy, at corruption. Those are kind of the three critical things in all of these countries and in Mexico too, so that if aid is there, whether it comes from the United States, the UN, or it's part of the national budget, it actually arrives and goes through a process of consultation and involvement with local communities so that alternative models of development can happen, better training of police, getting people, you know, getting the courts to work, all of those things.
So money and follow-up to make sure the money goes to the right place.
And yeah. then accountability.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. Well, a lot left to do, obviously. Yeah. Lynn Steven has been studying this for a while on both ends, has been to Huehuetenango and Quetzaltenango in Guatemala to look at why people head north, has also worked at a shelter in San Diego during her sabbatical year. She's an expert on immigration and asylum and works in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Oregon and has been our guest in this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure's been mine.
My pleasure.
That'll do it.